Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. My guest today is Willie Carlisle, who is a, what shall we call you, Willie? A folk musician? A musician, certainly. An artist, a poet. Can you just start by telling the people who you are and what you do?
I like to use the term folk singer. One word, no dash, and with a capital F. So my name is Willie Carlisle. I'm a folk singer, and I am inspired by a tradition of folkies that were in the political left, and I try to carry on their tradition the best that I'm able. I play banjo, fiddle, guitar, accordion, a whole bunch of other stuff in a variety of styles, learned either hand-to-hand from older masters or from younger revivalists or directly through the power of the internet. I'm self-taught in that regard, as in I have no formal musical education. I went to graduate school in Arkansas to study poetry and pretty quickly found out I needed to be a folk singer to do my best good.
Okay, that sounds great. Yeah, I mean, so as we were chatting a bit, I still haven't had any musicians on the show until you, and in part that is a matter of personal taste, which is to say the obvious kind of musician to have on this show would be a punk rocker. The connection between anarchy and punk is very strong, but I was more interested in the folk tradition and the left-wing folk tradition and the Wobblies and the Appalachians. So once I heard about you and your work, you were the one I wanted to have on the show first. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
I'm really grateful. I hope I represent the rest of us reasonably well.
Well, you don't need to represent. I mean, that's anarchism is against right, representation.
That's a good point. Well, I hope I'm not the last musician you have. I guess I'll just put it that way.
I don't want you to be either, but I'm glad you are the first. So let's just get it out of the way. Yeah. Let's talk about the new album, Winged Victory, before we talk about anything else, because I'm gonna release this episode. So the album comes out, I think, on June 27th. So this episode will come out around then. So tell the people what Winged Victory is.
It's a collection of 10 folk songs with Scott, one by a mentor and I hope friend of mine named Mark Ross, who was is an anarchist and is one of the last living members of the Rose Tattoo Collective, an anarchist collective of folk singers that included the late great Utah Phillips. There is an old wobbly folk song, We Fed You All for 1,000 Years, kicking the album off. And the center of the record is this song called Winged Victory, where I discuss the idea of a donkey named Winged Victory in the context of I guess, a whole bunch of anarchist-leaning social and political beliefs, demanding the impossible that no one is expendable. And so it's a record trying to investigate my own relationship to folk and material culture, as well as make some good music in the meantime. It's got banjos, fiddles, accordions, close harmonies, and a class-based critique as well.
Yes, it has all that. I can confirm it has all that. I've listened to the record. I quite enjoyed it. I guess, so I think maybe you've got like a, like if you look up your discography, you've got like a self-published album. I guess I haven't heard that, but I've heard Peculiar Missouri, Critterland, and then the collection of folk songs that was released through Anticorp. I don't remember what that's called. Could you remind me what that was called?
The Magnolia Sessions.
The Magnolia Sessions, yes. And I've loved all of it. I mean, I guess this is the part where I confess that I heard about you through the algorithm. Just Spotify was like, you will like this music. I'm trying to wean myself off Spotify. I'm trying to go vinyl, which is expensive and really more twee than I mean to. But Spotify recommended Critterland to me, and I just loved the song immediately, loved the album immediately. And I guess I don't have a question. The music is great, and listeners, I recommend that you listen to it. So we can leave it there, and Will, you can say anything you want in response to that.
Oh, sure. Well, first of all, thank you. I'm glad that amidst algorithmic slop, we ended up here. That song, Critterland, is based around trying to and failing to live out on a small intentional community in rural Arkansas. Some of the that underscores some of the values that are discussed there. Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know. Clearly I should have prepared better. I mean, if you've listened to the podcast, you know that preparation is not really my thing. I mean, I was listening to Wing Victory before. So let's do this. Let's talk about the tradition. The folk music tradition, the left-wing music tradition. How did you come to that? How did you become a folk singer in this tradition?
Well, so I was an academic. I started off going to a small liberal arts school. I was the first person in my family to do that, to go to have an educational experience like that. My parents are a cook turned chef and a physical therapist turned professor. My mother got her PhD in her 60s and sort of did that sort of long thing that you may hear many academics talk about, where it takes them forever. And she was always more interested in the clinical stuff. So when I got to school, I discovered the work of the American poet Carl Sandburg. And
Willie, I'm sorry, I have to break in. I almost mentioned Carl Sandburg, because I am in Flat Rock, North Carolina right now on a family vacation where Carl Sandburg, so I was at the Carl Sandburg house this morning.
Wow,
Willie.
Amazing.
I'm sorry. I don't think I have any Carl Sandburg in the room that I'm in, but we got Carl Sandburg books all over the place. I'm a huge fan. I worked on him in my dissertation. Sorry, keep talking now.
Yeah. Well, Sandburg was an inspiration to me. And was Walt Whitman, and I loved the most the way that Carl Sandburg would recite, his connection to regular people, and his really at the time and when he was first writing his pretty radical politics, his folk singing really attracted me. He was a bad guitar player, and not much of a singer, and his programs included huge amounts of the American folk canon that he often learned firsthand. So he arrived at a timely moment when the folk scare was kind of entering into American universities through the likes of Pete Seeger and many, many others. And that folk scare was very involved politically. Through that, I kind of discovered everyone else. My biggest hero would be Utah Phillips. I knew that I wanted to be a folk singer pretty much immediately, in that I guess I just saw it as a calling. I saw this stuff and I couldn't stop. So from that moment on, from being 18 or so, I was knew I would be in debt horrifically. Was 2008, so the housing market had collapsed, and the big bailouts were happening, and this kind of disenfranchisement that was all around was strongly felt in the small town that Carl Sandburg grew up in, that I happened to go to school in. It led to a bunch of punk musicians sort of beginning to work in that little town. There was a really neat little punk scene happening that included a lot of people that didn't have jobs, people that had been laid off from a Maytag plant closing nearby. I was a part of that. I thought that the way for me to do it would to be a punk singer. So I, I went pretty directly from a small town punk scene into being a folk singer, because that felt more durable. When I went to square dances, they were like mosh pits where an older person would lift you up off the ground and say, "Are you all right?" And you could say no. I really thought it was fascinating that groups of people could come together to make music that wasn't all "look at me, witness me, make me famous," but rather was like, we're a part of something that we agree to do together, and we take care of each other. And it really felt like a square dance. And I don't mean like a contest square dance, the kind of Henry Ford assembly line looking things with these huge costumes or something. But rather these kind of folk dances that friends and people who I now consider family would throw at their little collectives. So it was sort of like once I dipped a toe in, something grabbed my toe and yanked me in all the way. And I sort of from that moment on thought of school as a means to an end. I wanted to study folk music and I wanted to practice it. And so I knew I wanted to go places where I could learn more. And Arkansas was that place for me. So I moved to Arkansas and began to encounter people who had either learned from archives or old 78s or their parents or their grandparents, learning from people who had learned from people who learned from their grandparents and so on, as a way of trying to find this kind of deep but also very normal bioregional rootedness that I feel like is gone from most music. And gone from the way that we consider art. We consider an artist often an individual auteur instead of a member of a larger community. And folk music has always made me felt connected to a larger sense of community and a kind of historicity that embraces its materialism and doesn't let go of where it's been, that can use the ashes of an old thing to fertilize a new garden, is kind of the way I think about it.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I started with Sandberg, and I remember I was on my way to the Smithsonian Institute to try to dig up some stuff about Sandberg's singing and listen to some records that were not available anywhere. And on that trip, I was taking Greyhounds and sleeping on the ground, and it was kind of my most vigorous bumming around. It was the early days of couch surfing, and I would never claim hitchhiking or train hopping, and I'd never claim those subcultures, but I certainly would claim the a tramping subculture, where it's been more about travel than staying in one place for most of my life. That was my first experiences with that, and I fell in love with that. I remember I had the Harry Smith anthology and Utah Phillips record, "We Fed You All for 1,000 Years," with me. I think I might have had a doom metal CD or something like that as well. And at that time, my conversion was totally complete. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a ton of stuff there to pick up on, but the first one I want to pick up on is just this idea of art as, you know, the product of an integrated culture. I was listening recently to an interview with a First Nations activist in Canada who was talking about trying to get back artifacts that were owned by the Hudson Bay Company. Mm-hmm. And I could not agree more with this guy about trying to get the stuff back, the cultural objects that were taken. I mean, maybe they were paid for, but I mean, fuck that. But he said something that struck me as just so sad, which he said, "We're trying to get them back from the company because the company's going bankrupt and it might sell them. And they may just think they are art and they can sell them if it's art, but they don't understand that actually these are cultural items and therefore we want them back." And I just thought that claim that there's art, which is something separate from culture and in the market and belongs with dealers or in a museum. And then there's culture, which is, you know, alive and vibrant and sacred and matters. And you need to know which one you're dealing with, art or culture. It seems to me that I don't want to be dealing with art if that's what art means. The algorithmic slop, the divorced from the actual lives of people, and it's just a product. Does that make sense?
Yeah, the archive or the museum is more a zone of oppression, more a tax haven for. It's amazing in an age of total digital reproduction of all art on some level that we're still find its financial value in its rareness. And I don't know, I recently actually performed at an art museum in Arkansas. I have said this on stage many times, I guess, but at this moment I was trying to burn the bridge, just essentially saying that the people that founded this art museum, the Walton family, the people that run Walmart, who are union bust and can people, and are the largest employer in America, they've created a massive tax haven that they call a jewel on the hill, right? A free art museum for all people, the cost of which, a friend of mine did some napkin math, could have provided health care for the whole state of Arkansas for several years. Fine art is, I think, not a solution to any problem. And I'd sort of challenge any fine artist that thinks that they're, if they're creating in that environment, to ask themselves if why. And what sacrifice they could make that would be more real than the entirely fictional, or at least entirely financialized, efforts of most fine art.
Yeah, no, I think that's right, and it seems like the options are sort of like for an artist. I mean, you're trying to make money because money is how in this country one eats and lives, and your options are sort of, you know, the mass market, the algorithm, the clicks and sales. And then the other option is basically elite patronage, which might seem, especially if it's coming from a, you know, like a non-profit, like a museum type thing, might seem better, but honestly, probably the harsh red in tooth and claw market of Spotify is in some ways less corrupt, more open about what it is than the kind of nonprofit cultural space, if that sounds right to you. I'm sure I'm biting the hand that
sure, feeds here me. We are. Yeah. And our mouths will remain on it, and that's okay with me. I think that we have to live in that discomfort. I understand the impulse to talk to punks first in any conversation about this, right? Is that it's really sexy. It's a lot more sexy to be an insurrectionist than an incrementalist. I accept that. But if for example, look at the struggle of people like Kurt Cobain, every single act of protest is also a spectacle. Scripted and cliched moments. There's nothing more MTV than making fun of MTV on MTV, right? We have this, in the long run, sometimes I think it's an obsession with martyrdom more than a belief in, like an attempt to do the right thing with the means that you're given, and to embrace the kind of, I guess, to use the name of your podcast, embracing as many everyday anarchisms as possible, instead of giving way to despair and then ultimately total martyrdom, which I do think about all the time. I think that it could be paralytic if you just, we could spend the whole hour here that we're talking weighing whether or not it's better to do one or the other, right? To engage in the nonprofit industrial complex or to be run roughshod over. If you work with Ticketmaster, you're working with Saudi oil princes on some level because they own a good portion of it, right? There's no ethical consumption, right? All externality is incorporated. Late capitalism colonizes our dreams. It gives us what we want. We're holding a slot machine in our pocket. In my mind, what we want to win back is certain mental communitarian freedoms, space between your ears, to choose where we're at, to choose what we listen to choose what we engage with, and to clearly define why and to cultivate that kind of thing. And I think with folk music, sometimes it gets held up as some kind of traditionalist dream, some kind of, I guess, cottagecore thing. But I kind of want to argue that traditionalism isn't a value so much as it is a fact of our need to connect with people. I really enjoyed reading David Graeber because of this, right? Is that there's lots of different ways that societies organize themselves, and that one historical pathway, the inexorable creation of a certain kind of state, is not real, right? But one thing that can be is that we are not innately anything, that we can innately choose to be things, and that we still have that power, even if it becomes harder and harder to exercise. And I want folk music to be a pathway towards that for myself and other people, to meaningfully encounter the work that people have done before us to gain mental, social freedom against all odds, without having to, I guess, throw ourselves on the rocks of being perfect all the time.
I think that's fantastic. I think I have nothing to add to that, if that's okay.
That's all right. I think I really have enjoyed Bertolt Brecht, the German playwright of the Weimar, who said that there's nothing more annoying than an apolitical concert, because when people leave, they leave with a sense of depoliticized enervation. And here we are in a time of bread and circuses. And I don't think it's that much to ask of our art that inside of the fortune cookie, there is a, you know, on one side, there's a nonsense fortune. But on the other side, it says, hey, here's a way you could help your neighbor. Here's a way that you can win back some of your freedom. Here's a way that you can commit yourself to a life more in keeping with your own decision-making power.
Brecht is really important to me as well. And one of the reasons why I've had, filmmakers on the podcast, and one of the reasons why I haven't yet or hadn't yet necessarily had musicians, is there's a way, for me at least, that there's often a compulsion about music. It's often music often demands something from you. It carries you away. I mean, of course, this isn't, John Cage is the opposite of this. He's doing something Brechtian or beyond Brecht. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh no, go ahead. You go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. So I'm really interested. I mean, I've been watching. I'm a cinephile, as listeners to this podcast know, and I just keep spending more and more time with just the sparest of cinemas, maybe not the sparest of cinemas, but pretty spare cinema, like the films of Ozu, where very little happens. And then if I watch a Marvel movie, or even recently I saw this film Sinners by the director Ryan Coogler, which got very good reviews. It's an action thriller horror thing, and it the film wants to carry you. It uses editing and sound and plot and the charisma of Michael B. Jordan to bring you someplace, to make you feel something, to in some ways short circuit your brain and thrill you. And it does so to make a film that you want to watch, unlike the Marvel movies, which I think just do so to take your money. And Brecht says that kind of play, at least, I mean, he's writing about plays, not cinema, is designed to return you to the world, having lost something. And you can't really think. I mean, he says you can't think when you're watching this kind of movie, again, or this kind of play.
Right.
And yeah. And it seems to me that there is a Spotify doesn't want you to be able to think when you are listening to music. And I'm sure there's plenty of Beyonce and Taylor Swift fans listening to this podcast right now, because it seems like everyone is a fan of one or both of those musicians. But I've been watching I haven't gone to one of their concerts, but I've been watching to the spectacle that they put on, and it just seems devoted to the absence of thought and just the total evacuation of the self during the musical performance in a way that strikes me in a Brechtian way as politically dangerous. Now, I don't know. Now I'm just yammering on. So please say something in response.
I will. So, well, I appreciate it. The way when I think about tradition is a thing that can ground it, as can context, right? I find that the choice to make a spectacle absurdly large is them making that decision. Especially if it's not for any purpose, especially if the performer is so often a cipher for anyone, right? Taylor Swift is every American girl, right? And really every person, right? Is writing about the most commonplace things, emotional things at least. And something I've been really affected by is Peter Schembre, the founder of the Bread and Puppet Theater, makes it this marvelous cheap art manifesto that sort of talks about using trash to create an art. And I find that the transformation that we're asking audiences to make doesn't have to be pure spectacle. It can have ideology built into it. I think about what a puppet is doing, or just the game of peekaboo doing with a kid in the mirror stage. Or just being like, is your finger a person or is it not? For a moment, I thought it was a person. That little piece of magic that's still what's happening when something isn't 100% mimetic, right? When we're not looking at a statue turned performer, I feel like our theory hasn't caught up with reality, in that you can fake a person's existence. Or put somebody on a jumbotron so large that the population of an average city a couple hundred years ago can fit into something and watch a performer, right? Yeah. The scale becomes like kind of deeply inhuman. And I think a way to humanize the scale of performances is to keep them at a certain level and to make sure that they have, that they're not for everybody, but that they're for that they're welcoming to everybody, but not necessarily for everybody. And it's a little bit that way with folk music, right? You have a tradition, you share your tradition, and you engage in it, and you try to give it to people. you have a set of values that you're trying to transfer. I've recently done some amphitheater shows that I did not think I would enjoy, and I did. As I sort of, the scale of the amphitheater is kind of gross to me, because it's, you know, these jumbotrons, these, and when I talk about a puppet, what I mean is like primitivism is a really helpful tool, I think, right? The magic is the same on the jumbotron and in the tiny puppet is what I mean. But this guy I was opening for, this famous country artist, Tyler Childers, he has a lot of hymns, a lot of religious songs that he's turned into these soul numbers. You're taking the Baptist hymnal and you're making it into these barn-burning soul numbers. And there's also, they happen to be, Tyler happens to be a Hare Krishna. And the invocations to Krishna that occur during those gospel performances are provocative, to say the least, right? And if somebody doesn't get it, that's fine. But it's more than an Easter egg, you know? And it's also based around a belief that the act of singing is bringing people in a closer to a God consciousness. It has this deep social, political, and traditional meaning attached to it at the scale of an amphitheater. I don't know if I would do it the same way. I probably will never have the opportunity. But knowing that at the same time, at a similar sized amphitheater, most people are doing performances totally disconnected from religion, tradition, anything of the sort, and just trying to make everyone agree. I appreciated that a lot, and it made me like the performances a lot more than I thought I would.
Yeah, I think this idea that you're trying to make everyone agree, I've run these arguments by relatively few people, but I think that's the hard part to convince them, like, oh, you know, if you're at, I mean, I mentioned Beyonce or Taylor Swift, but the same goes for whatever, U2 or the Rolling Stones. I think you're right. You're trying to make everyone agree, but I don't think they would think anything is happening on an agreement level. Does that make sense? They would just say, like, what do you mean? Agree. I'm enjoying the music. We're all enjoying the music. That's why we're at this concert.
It's why, like, George Santana saying, someday there's just going to be music and love, man, is, like, not a useful message, right? Sure, yes, someday we all will turn into light, yes. But, like, not now, and in the meantime, there's work to be done. So I just don't think it scales. I kind of think that superstardom is... Utah Phillips, the anarchist who I probably admire most and who I do not follow well probably, said that you should not overestimate the good you can do with bad money. And when he received an offer from Johnny Cash to do an album of covers, Johnny Cash wanted to do an album of covers of Utah Phillips songs, he said no. And it's because he didn't want to overestimate the good he could do with bad money. I sort of think that to reach a certain level, you're making peace with some of that, or at least trying to engage in a warfare on a different level, or you become an incrementalist and a little insurrectionist piece of you goes away. I, for one, am a lot less Molotov cocktail than I am what I hope to be, like a more like a situationist drinking a cocktail. if you will, wandering around inside of various folk traditions and trying to find freedom inside of there that feels like it's everyone's birthright, that I want to be able to give to people, and that I feel like I discover in a real psychophysical way, in a journey through the history of my country and our kind of shared struggles in humanity. And so I think that while a punk band being furious and screaming all the time is excellent, oftentimes I also want there to be room for a love song. I want there to be bread and roses, right? Regarding whether or not I do think of myself as an anarchist, but I on stage I make the joke that I'm a Marxist, but I'm a Groucho Marxist, in that I wouldn't want to be a part of a club that would have me as a member. And I kind of think of that in terms of, that's how I think of it. I want music to be like a mental utopia in a group of realists, in a commons full of realists and incrementalists doing everything that we can, doing more than the average person. And I think that when we look at what music does, it can be a catalyst. And that is, I think, what I view the job of artists to be. I want to make reference to this moment that Pete Seeger had, where he's playing all these union halls in the 60s and 70s, a time that where folk music was in vogue. And you have all of these guys in Pittsburgh, if I recall, actually saying, like, why are you bringing this hillbilly music here? This is not what we listen to. It's not what we like. And I don't know any of these old songs. How am I supposed to know these old songs, right? these old union songs that are to me, you know, 40, 50 years old. They're my not even my parents' music. Come on, man. And I think that's a really nice reminder that no matter what kind of thing you're doing, you have to create your own context. You can't assume that everybody's going to have your same context just because something is based in a certain tradition or something, right? It has to be inclusive of a big range of experiences. So, and I've found myself to be kind of critical of the inventor. I think of Pete Seeger as the inventor of the folk singing profession, really. I'm kind of critical of where it ended up. It ended up in a kind of globalist world music that is really easily really easily shifted into a kind of WTO mindset, right? Music is everywhere and for everyone, and a shakuhachi should play with a banjo and stuff like that. And I'd like to be more, I guess, focused.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And I mean, all of that sounds right. And how you, I don't know. I mean, I guess we don't need to go back. We mentioned what it is to, you know, be part of that system and a part of it. And I do, I mean, for me, it's obvious the answer is everyday anarchism. And in terms of, you know, this question of what it is to be an anarchist, I mean, I sort of feel that I am a Groucho Marxist. That's good. I feel like with the non-anarchists, with the liberals and the progressives, I'm an anarchist, and with the anarchists, I feel like I'm, you know, some sort of reform-minded liberal. I'm trying to balance that. I don't know how well I'm doing. I certainly, you know, have a job and health insurance and a mortgage. And I know there's people who think you're not really in the anarchist tradition if you have those things. And I know why they feel that way. But
there's people that are, I mean, so that I've gotten to do this at a pretty high level. I'll describe two different festivals as an example, right? Large scale festivals in folk music that are problematic in these ways. The Newport Folk Festival was founded by Pete Seeger as a fundraiser to clean up the Hudson Bay. Everybody got paid the exact same amount, whether you were Earl Scruggs or a backup singer. It was based around folk music that was oftentimes not, quote, famous at the time. And now it costs $1,500 to go to Newport Folk Festival for 3 days. And they have everything from pop country artists to pop artists, as well as some folk artists. I think when I was there singing some protest songs, it felt like to some people, like a return to roots. But those roots are advertised and not actualized because the festival is obsessed with growth. It is at its maximum growth point. You cannot fit more people onto the small island that Newport Folk Festival takes place on. You can't, it sells out immediately. But they're still growing, right? Then there's also Hardly Strictly Bluegrass that happens in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. It was set up by Hellman, the guy that invented the mayonnaise, right? A multimillionaire who created a foundation to fund a free folk festival in the park in perpetuity, where people come and go. It has a scale that is large, but has not yet been exceeded, has remained free, and can stand to host smaller artists. They had Alice Girard there just last year, who is a marvelous leftist folk singer in the tradition of Hazel Dickens and the mining organizers, who were literally fighting against the American government dropping bombs on labor organizers, right? Both of those festivals are, have their intersections with big, powerful entities that, in my mind, shouldn't exist. One, I think, manages it better, and I guess I would leave it up to the listener to decide which one. But my favorite festivals are the ones that happen on a ground level, that are sustainable, that serve their communities, and that find a way in an industry that has an obsession with money. The industry exists because of money. I would not have management or a booking agent or anything if I couldn't fill any seats. I admire festivals and gatherings that find a way to manage those interests gracefully and not in competition with the people that live in those spaces, but in collaboration with them. And I think that the farther we get away from fine art and the closer that we get to folk art, the more successful that stuff is. And the farther away we get from exclusively having a profit motive, the better it gets. So when I envision a better music industry, and what I think I would like for listeners of your podcast to think about, is when you consume music, ask yourself how it can activate us. And what it can activate us towards, what little ways we can demand the impossible by finding music in and community at the same time. And by asking our music to not just be an aesthetic experience, but to connect us to people. I don't think it usually does that, and I also don't think it's a part of our life that has been deterritorialized in that way very often, because of its, I think it's, music, pop, music is one of the oldest, at this point, ways that our brains were made into the mush that it feels like they are now, right? The first time you heard the radio, I have to know whether the McRib is coming or going, right? But the first radio stations were some of the first ways that all American audiences heard the same advertisement, right? The National Barn Dance was something all Americans could tune into that was commodifying hillbilly music, right? Taking this stuff made by people who would show up to recording sessions in suits because they wanted to look their best, and then having the producers say, will you put on these overalls for this photo shoot, right? I think we should be aware of that too when we think about, okay, this traditional music, this is real. These hillbillies, this is real. These singers, this is certain things are real. I think our encounter with the real happens inside of us, and it's like a personal, both a personal and community realization that we're not encouraged to have because we've lost it for so long. The jingle, the top 40 radio, just the ability to not know that Taylor Swift has another record. It's almost impossible to not know, to not care, and to choose something different. Old time music, folk music has helped me do that. The way it connects with dance and the way dance connects people with people, I have been able to use this as a paradigm to talk with people that disagree with me. Socially, politically, for a very long time. And I think that we as a country kind of need that. And I'm not really a kumbaya person. I'm a let's have a disagreement person. I want music to do that for us kind of out in the open. not in the ways that it kind of subtly happens in folk and country music oftentimes. Actually, this is the way I want it to be. This is why I like folk and country music, is because it at least implies it more directly. This is a conservative song. This is a liberal song. Happens a lot, right? I will probably never be in the fold of certain musicians because they're either afraid of my politics or because they just don't want to dip their toes in, which is, that says basically enough to me. You know what I mean? It does say enough to me.
I don't know if this is someone you're a fan of, but didn't Sturgill Simpson busk outside the Country Music Awards for Planned Parenthood or something like that? Like that struck me as there are sides here, and I feel like I know which one he's on.
Right. And Sturgill Simpson is one of those people who has intentionally, if you ask the establishment what he's done, he's intentionally tanked his career over and over again. But to me, the new is almost impossible to attain, right? Even the aforementioned Kurt Cobain is like, every punk thing I try to do, people love for the wrong reasons, right? It's everything is immediately incorporated. MTV loves my protest acts. So the only thing to do is to do a kind of saying enough is enough. I think over and over again about that study done in, I think it was the Netherlands or maybe Denmark, that kind of discovered the limits of happiness as correlated to income, right? Yeah. It found that, I think that it correlated to something like $70,000 in health insurance a year, is after that you don't get much happier. The mental state that our constant competition puts us in is concomitant with the total destruction of the environment, right? With wanting more things, cheap things made of plastic, and having this consumerist compulsion, addiction, eradicates our ability to make like new discoveries that are right in front of us. And so I think of these kind of self-destructive acts as acts of integrity. And the same with Tyler Childers and the Hare Krishna moment, is sort of saying, I know you might not get this, but enough is enough. And infinite growth is not sustainable financially, but infinite growth of the spirit is actually possible and attainable and what we can look for. I'm not very cynical about the new in that way, right? I think that the new comes from, can exist. It just would require us to make sacrifices once enough is enough. And when I speak to audiences, it's primarily solidarity with what is happening in the regular world that I'm writing about. And then also a call to action to other people. If you can collect fine art or you can invest, well, then you have enough to self-destruct in a meaningful way. Put yourself a little bit on the gears of the machine, or at least put a pinky toe in there. I admire watching people like Sturgill do that. And I wonder, and people like Utah Phillips saying, I don't want Johnny Cash's money.
That's fantastic. Look, as you were talking, I thought of one more question I wanted to ask, but also we're pretty much at the end of our hour, so if you need to go, that's fine.
No, I'm here.
Okay. So I've been thinking, I wasn't sure if I was going to ask this, but I've been thinking about this a lot ever since I've been listening to your music. Thinking about the first track of Peculiar Missouri and the first track of Winged Victory, I agree with you that the heart is a big tent and you got to let everybody in. And I agree that, you know, the poor have had war waged upon them by the wealthy. And I myself have I agree with both those things, and I have a hard time holding them in my head at the same time, because it's the first thing that you'll hear if you start talking about anarchism, and you know, and if you start talking about universal love or anything like that, the question is, what are you going to do with the assholes? What are you going to do with the bad people? What are you going to do with the rich? How do you let them into your heart when it's clear that they are holding you outside of it? And of course, you know, it seems like racism and homophobia, it's just people on the left aren't willing to put those people in their heart. And it seems those people being the racists and the homophobics, not black sure, people yeah. or queer people. Uh-huh. I don't know how to feel about this. And listening to your music, it seems like that both these currents are there. And I don't know. Do you have any way to think or feel about it?
When you look at, if you look at music as, if you look at, especially at oral music and its transmission and the people that have transmitted it, you encounter a lot of average shitty people. When you look at your, I just wrote this song called the Self-Compassion Polka that I will quote here, even though it's not recorded and you can't hear it anywhere, which is, you might think that you're awful, but really you're not. It's normal to die, to be fat and poor and die and be forgot. Evolution played a trick on you and me where it's normal to be stupid because you're a human being. When we encounter music as like in its historical or materialist context, you encounter so many normal bad people, so many, you can learn from so many normally racist people. In old time music, you encounter racist names of fiddle tunes. You encounter people who were undoubtedly incredibly homophobic and racist. It's not about separating the art from the artist. It's actually saying that I can wholly embrace a certain part of this thing's humanity, that the poetical act or impulse, the impulse towards creation, exists amongst people and can be celebrated amongst everybody, I think is where I hang my hat, is that you can't deny anybody their fundamental humanity when it is an average lack of humanity that they hold for other people, which is to say you can't fight oligarchs unless you have enough people that are being manipulated by them. You go for the big baddie, in my mind. The rest of it is, especially as a white, straight-looking person that's 6'4", navigating the world, that's my rule for myself, is that it's my job to be a translator and to walk between different worlds because I can, and to try to bring the best thing to both of those. And then hold no space for a certain kind of people insofar as I am always willing to tell them what I think and do so to their face, and I'm working on it, actually. It's a struggle for me to tell them to their face all the times, and I'm doing better than ever, for what it's worth, in that regard. We're burning more bridges than ever. I have regretted none of it. And because the agreement that feels, something Annan Hennessy, Utah Phillips mentor, said, is that the essence of contract is agreement, not obedience or coercion. And the best contract that I can think of in the music industry, and one I think that is worth returning to, is $10 to $20 at the door, cash for entertainment, disposable income for something that makes you happy, right? Insofar as that's how I'm able to connect them, connect universal love, with also, we've fed you all for 1,000 years and enough is enough.
That's fantastic, Willie. That's fantastic. Anything else you would like to share before I let you go?
Just that I'm not alone in this. I have a lot of colleagues in this. The folk artist Jesse Wells has exploded on the internet in TikTok and elsewhere with a bunch of political folk songs. An Arkansas colleague of mine, Nick Shoulders, writes very trenchantly about this stuff. I guess I mean that in the folk and country world, like political artists are legion and having a renaissance right now. But that these little renaissances also come from small DIY communities where somebody pays $5 to $10 to $5, $10, $15, $20 a Fugazi-esque rate. To get into a place where there's still some mental freedom. And I don't know that it can exist at the amphitheater and somebody trying to win that stuff back. I think lots of people know this that are listen to your show. But if they don't, I kind of want to encourage people to seek it out and to foster it when they see it. Because I've been very lucky that I had a community of traditionalists to hold me up. And also, had some aspects of an education amongst hillbillies and hippies and back to the landers to help me get where I'm at. So I think I just want to encourage listeners to explore that and to be a part of it, because it's just not hard and there's a lot of us.
That's awesome. Thank you, Willie. Check out Winged Victory and check out Critterland and the Magnolia Sessions and Peculiar Missouri. They're wonderful. Willie, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.